Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, 20 years on, we revisit Princess Diana, not her death, but her life. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. Was it really 20 years ago? Diana died in 1997. Diana and Charles' marriage was on the rocks in 1995, and the BBC interviewed her, in fact Martin Bashir to be precise, on the Panorama programme. There are a couple of interesting programmes about Diana. One is called Unlawful Killing, a documentary made a couple of years ago by Keith Allen, which is still actually banned here in Britain. But one film that's not banned is this Diana interview with the BBC's Martin Bashir.
Your Royal Highness, how prepared were you for the pressures that came with marrying into the royal family?
At the age of 19, you always think you're prepared for everything and you think you have the knowledge of what's coming ahead. But although I was daunted at the prospect at the time, I felt I had the support of my husband-to-be.
What were the expectations that you had for married life?
I think like any marriage, especially when you've had divorced parents like myself, you'd want to try even harder to make it work, and you don't want to fall back into a pattern that you've seen happen in your own family. I desperately wanted to work. I desperately love my husband, and I wanted to share everything together. And I thought that we were a very good team.
How aware were you of the significance of what had happened to you? After all, you'd become Princess of Wales, ultimately with a view to becoming queen.
I wasn't daunted, and I'm not daunted by the responsibilities that that role creates. It was a challenge. It is a challenge. As for becoming queen, it was never at the forefront of my mind when I married my husband. It was a long way off, that thought. The most daunting aspect was the media attention, because my husband and I, we were told when we got engaged that the media go quietly, and it didn't. And then when we were married, they said it would go quietly, and it didn't. And then it started to focus very much on me, and I seemed to be on the front of a newspaper every single day, which is isolating experience. And the higher the media puts you, place you, is the bigger the drop, and I was very aware of that.
How did you handle the transition from being Lady Diana Spencer to the most photographed, the most talked about woman in the world?
Well, it took a long time to understand why people were so interested in me, but I assumed it was because my husband had done a lot of wonderful work leading up to our marriage and our relationship. But then during the years, you see yourself as a good product that sits on a shelf and sells well, and people make a lot of money out of you.
It's been suggested in some newspapers that you were left largely to cope with your new status on your own. Do you feel that was your experience?
Yes, I do, on reflection. But then here was a situation which hadn't ever happened before in history, in the sense that the media were everywhere, and here was a fairy story that everybody wanted to work. And so it was isolating. But it was also a situation where you couldn't indulge in feeling sorry for yourself. You had to either sink or swim, and you had to learn that very fast.
And what did you do?
I swam. We went to Alice Springs, to Australia, and we went and did a walkabout, and I said to my husband, "What do I do now?" And he said, "Go over to the other side and speak to them." I said, "I can't, just can't." He said, "Well, you've got to do it." And he went off and did his bit, and I went off and did my bit. It practically finished me off there and then, and I suddenly realised, I went back to my hotel room and realised the impact that, you know, I had to sort myself out. We had a 6-week tour 4 weeks in Australia and 2 weeks in New Zealand. And by the end, when we flew back from New Zealand, I was a different person. I realised the sense of duty, the level of intensity of interest, and the demanding role I now found myself in.
Were you overwhelmed by the pressure from people initially?
Yes, I was very daunted because, as far as I was concerned, I was a fat, chubby 20-year-old, 21-year-old, and I couldn't understand the level of interest.
At this early stage, would you say that you were happily married?
Very much so. But the pressure on us both as a couple with the media was phenomenal and misunderstood by a great many people. We'd be going around Australia, for instance, and all you could hear was, oh, she's on the other side. Now, if you're a man, or my husband, a proud man, you mind about that. You hear it every day for 4 weeks, and you feel low about it, you know, instead of feeling happy and sharing it.
When you say she's on the other side, what do you mean?
Well, they weren't on the right side to wave at me or to touch me.
So they were expressing a preference even then for you rather than your husband?
Yes, which I felt very uncomfortable with, and I felt it was unfair because I wanted to share.
But were you flattered by the media attention particularly?
No, not particularly, because with the media attention came a lot of jealousy. A great deal of complicated situations arose because of that.
At this early stage in your marriage, what role did you see for yourself as Princess of Wales? Did you have an idea of the role that you might like to fulfil?
No, I was very confused by which area I should go into. Then I found myself being more and more involved with people who were rejected by society, I'd say drug addicts, alcoholism, battered this, battered that, and I found an affinity there. And I respected very much the honesty I found on that level with people I met, because in hospices, for instance, when people are dying, they're much more open and more vulnerable and much more real than other people, and I appreciated that.
Had the palace given any thought to the role that you might have as Princess of Wales?
No. No one sat me down with a piece of paper and said, this is what's expected of you. But there again, I'm lucky enough, the fact that I have found my role, and I'm very conscious of it, and I love being with people.
So you very much created the role that you would pursue for yourself, really? That was
yes.
What you did?
I think so. I remember when I used to sit on hospital beds and hold people's hands, people used to be sort of shocked because they said they'd never seen this before, and to me it was quite a normal thing to do. And when I saw the reassurance that an action like that gave, I did it everywhere, and we'll always do that.
It wasn't long after the wedding before you became pregnant. What was your reaction when you learnt that the child was a boy?
Enormous relief. I felt the whole country was in labour with me. And enormous relief, but I had actually known William was going to be a boy because the scan had shown it, so of course no surprise.
Had you always wanted to have a family?
Yes, I came from a family where there were four of us, so we had enormous fun there. And then William and Harry arrived, fortunately two boys. It would have been a little tricky if it had been two girls, but that in itself brings responsibilities of bringing them up. William, his future being as it is, and Harry are sort of like a form of a backup in that aspect.
How did the rest of the royal family react when they learnt that the child that you were to have was going to be a boy?
Well, everybody was thrilled to bits. It was been quite a difficult pregnancy. I hadn't been very well throughout it. So by the time William arrived, it was great relief because it was all peaceful again and I was well for a time. Then I was unwell with postnatal depression, which no one ever discusses postnatal depression. You have to read about it afterwards. And that in itself was a bit of a difficult time. You'd wake up in the morning feeling you didn't want to get out of bed, you felt misunderstood, and just very, very low in yourself.
Was this completely out of character for you?
Yes, very much so. I've never had a depression in my life. But then when I analysed it, I could see that the changes I'd made in the last year had all caught up with me, and my body had said, we want a rest.
So what treatment did you actually receive?
I received a great deal of treatment, but I knew myself that actually what I needed was space and time to adapt to all the different roles that had come my way. I knew I could do it, but I needed people to be patient and give me the space to do it.
When you say all of the different roles that had come your way, what do you mean?
Well, it was a very short space of time. In a space of a year, my whole life had changed, turned upside down, and it had its wonderful moments, but it also had challenging moments, and I could see where the rough edges needed to be smoothed.
What was the family's reaction to your postnatal depression?
Well, maybe I was the first person ever to be in this family who ever had a depression or was ever openly tearful. And obviously that was daunting, because if you've never seen it before, how do you support it?
What effect did the depression have on your marriage?
Well, it gave everybody a wonderful new label. It's Diana's unstable and Diana's mentally imbalanced. And unfortunately, that seems to have stuck on and off over the years.
Are you saying that that label stuck within your marriage?
I think people used it, and it stuck, yes.
According to press reports, it was suggested that it was around this time things became so difficult that you actually tried to injure yourself.
Mm.
Is that true?
Mm. When no one listens to you, or you feel no one's listening to you, all sorts of things start to happen. For instance, you have so much pain inside yourself that you try and hurt yourself on the outside because you want help, but it's the wrong help you're asking for. People see it as crying wolf or attention-seeking, and they think because you're in the media all the time, you've got enough attention, inverted commas. But I was actually crying out because I wanted to get better in order to go forward and continue my duty and my role as wife, mother, Princess of Wales. So, yes, I did inflict upon myself. I didn't like myself. I was ashamed that I couldn't cope with the pressures.
What did you actually do?
Well, I just hurt my arms and my legs. And I work in environments now where I see women doing similar things, and I'm able to understand completely where they're coming from.
What was your husband's reaction to this when you began to injure yourself in this way?
Well, I didn't actually always do it in front of him. But obviously anyone who loves someone would be very concerned about it.
Did he understand what was behind the physical act of hurting yourself, do you think?
No, but then not many people would have taken the time to see that.
Were you able to admit that you were in fact unwell, or did you feel compelled simply to carry on performing as the Princess of Wales?
I felt compelled to perform. Well, when I say perform, I was compelled to go out and do my engagements and not let people down and support them and love them. And in a way, by being out in public, they supported me, although they weren't aware just how much healing they were giving me, and it carried me through.
But did you feel that you had to maintain the public image of a successful Princess of Wales?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
The depression was resolved, as you say, but it was subsequently reported that you suffered bulimia.
Mm.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. I had bulimia for a number of years. And that's like a secret disease you inflicted upon yourself because your self-esteem is at a low ebb and you don't think you're worthy or valuable. You fill your stomach up 4 or 5 times a day, some do it more, and it gives you a feeling of comfort. It's like having a pair of arms around you, but it's temporary. Then you are disgusted at the bloatedness of your stomach, and then you bring it all up again. And it's a repetitive pattern, which is very destructive to yourself.
How often would you do that on a daily basis?
Depends on the pressures going on. If I'd been on what I call an away day, where I'd been up part of the country all day, I'd come home feeling pretty empty because my engagements at that time would be to do with people dying, people very sick, people, marriages, the problem, all that. And I'd come home and it would be very difficult to know how to comfort myself, having been comforted lots of other people. So it would be a regular pattern to jump into the fridge. It was a symptom of what was going on in my marriage. I was crying out for help, but giving the wrong signals. And people were using my bulimia as a coat on a hanger. They decided that was the problem. Diana was unstable.
instead of looking behind the symptom at the cause. What was the cause?
The cause was a situation where my husband and I had to keep everything together because we didn't want to disappoint the public. And yet, there was a lot of anxiety going on within our four walls.
You mean between the two of you? And so you subjected yourself to this phase of binging and vomiting?
You could say the word subjected, but it was my escape mechanism, and it worked for me at that time.
Did you seek help from any other members of the royal family?
No. You have to know that when you have bulimia, you're very ashamed of yourself, and you hate yourself, so... and people think you're wasting food. So you don't discuss it with people. And the thing about bulimia is your weight always stays the same, whereas with anorexia you visibly shrink. So you can pretend the whole way through. There's no proof.
When you say people would think you were wasting food, did anybody suggest that to you?
Oh yes, a number of times.
What was said?
Well, it was just, I suppose you're going to waste that food later on. You know, that was pressure in itself. And of course I would, because it was my release valve.
How long did this bulimia go on for?
A long time. But I'm free of it now.
2 years? 3 years?
A little bit more than that.
According to reports in the national press, it was at around this time that you began to experience difficulties in your marriage and your relationship to the Prince of Wales. Is that true?
Well, we were a newly married couple, so obviously we had those pressures too, and we had the media who were completely fascinated by everything we did. And it was difficult to share that load because I was the one who was always pitched out front, whether it was my clothes, what I said, what my hair was doing, everything. It was a pretty dull subject, actually, and it's been exhausted over the years. When actually what we wanted to support it was our work, and as a team.
What effect did the press interest in you have on your marriage?
It made it very difficult, because for a situation where it was a couple working in the same job, we got out the same car, shook the same hand, my husband did the speeches, I did the handshaking. So basically we were a married couple doing the same job, which is very difficult for anyone, and more so if you've got all the attention on you. We struggled a bit with it was very difficult, and then my husband decided that we'd do separate engagements, which was a bit sad for me, because I quite liked the company. But there again, I didn't have the choice.
So it wasn't at your request that you did that on your own?
Not at all.
The biography of the Prince of Wales, written by Jonathan Dimbleby, which, as you know, was published last year, suggested that you and your husband had very different outlooks, very different interests. Would you agree with that?
No. Work in the cancer field, work in hospices. But I was portrayed in the media at that time, if I remember rightly, as someone, because I hadn't passed any O-levels and taken any A-levels, and I made the grave mistake once of saying to a child I was thick as a plank, in order to ease the child's nervousness, which it did. But that headline went all around the world, and I rather regret saying it.
The Prince of Wales, in the biography, is described as a great thinker, a man with a tremendous range of interests. What did he think of your interests?
Well, I don't think I was allowed to have any. I think that I've always been the 18-year-old girl he got engaged to, so I don't think I've been given any credit for growth. And my goodness, I've had to grow.
Explain what you mean when you say that.
Well,
when you say you were never given any credit, what do you mean?
Well, anything good I ever did, nobody ever said a thing, never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
How did you cope with that?
Well, obviously there were lots of tears, and one could dive into the bulimia and to escape.
Some people would find that difficult to believe, that you were left so much to cope on your own, and that the description you give suggests that your relationship with your husband was not very good even at that early stage.
Well, we had unique pressures put upon us, and we both tried our hardest to cover them up, but obviously it wasn't to be.
Around 1986, again according to the biography written by Jonathan Dimbleby about your husband, he says that your husband renewed his relationship with Mrs. Camilla Parker Bowles. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I was. But I wasn't in a position to do anything about it.
What evidence did you have that their relationship was continuing even though you were married?
A woman's instinct is a very good one.
Is that all?
Well, I had knowledge of it.
From staff?
Well, from people who minded and cared about our marriage, yes.
What effect did that have on you?
Pretty devastating. Rampant bulimia, if you can have rampant bulimia, and just a feeling of being no good at anything and being useless and hopeless and failed in every direction. Wow.
And with a husband who was having a relationship with somebody else?
Was a husband who loved someone else, yes.
You really thought that?
Mm-hmm. I didn't think that, I knew it.
How did you know it?
By the change of behavioural pattern in my husband, for all sorts of reasons that a woman's instinct produces. You just know. It was already difficult, but it became increasingly difficult.
In a practical sense, how did it become difficult?
Well, people were... When I say people, I mean friends on my husband's side were indicating that I was, again, unstable, sick, and should be put in a home of some sort in order to get better. I was almost an embarrassment.
Do you think he really thought that?
Well, there's no better way to dismantle a personality than to isolate it.
So you were isolated?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Do you think Mrs. Parker Bowles was a factor in the breakdown of your marriage?
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
You're effectively living separate lives, yet in public there's this appearance of this happily married royal couple. How was this regarded by the royal family?
I think everybody was very anxious because they could see there were complications but didn't want to interfere, but were there, made it known that they were there if required.
Do you think it was accepted that one could live effectively two lives, one in private and one in public?
No, because again, the media was very interested about our setup, inverted commas, when we went abroad. We had separate apartments, albeit we're on the same floor, so of course that was leaked and that caused complications. But Charles and I had our duty to perform, and that was paramount.
So in a sense you coped with these two lives because mm-hmm. of your duty?
Mm-hmm. And we were a very good team in public, albeit what was going on in private, we were a good team.
Some people would find that difficult to reconcile.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's their problem. I know what it felt like.
Princess Diana speaking to the BBC's Martin Bashir on the Panorama programme, and that was in November 1995. Within 2 years, Diana was dead. Yes, it really was 20 years ago. And we'll have more of that interview, the second half, next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, every few weeks we have Bristol Underground Church in here, at least we have the last couple of months, to talk about various churches around the city they've visited. They've given them a bit of a checklist out of 10, got their clipboard out and said, well, we think this is a great church and this isn't. So this is nothing scientific really about this survey at all. But I understand, Bridget, that you've been recently to one of the Brethren churches, in fact, both of the Brethren churches. Can you just tell us initially, what are the Brethren?
Well, the Brethren are a church very out on their own. They started off with George Mullard and his companion at the time, and they later split up into two churches.
How old is the church? Do you know how far it goes
18
back?
Something, right. Whenever the orphanages were opened by Mullard around that time. The other man was Irish, and he ended up splitting, so they went in two different directions, and it became the Plymouth Brethren as well as the Exclusive Brethren.
Right, now, last time you went to the Plymouth Brethren, didn't you? I think, was it Filton Avenue?
Yes, yes.
And you quite enjoyed it. It was a small gathering.
Very small, very nice, very friendly.
Singing?
Yes, there was singing, and not too many people there, and everyone took their turns to give a word.
Dance,
men.
Dancing and jumping
no
around?
No dancing, no. They were sort of just inviting us in, making us feel at home, and it was really good. We enjoyed it.
The idea was that they made a bit of space for people who were part of the church to actually say something as ministry, as part of the service.
Yes, yes. Men were speaking, no women spoke. And I think it went off very quietly and very quickly. There wasn't very much to it.
Well, there's even parts of the Church of England now that are starting to do that kind of thing, to say we'd like people to contribute as part of the service. So,
yes.
But that was the last time we spoke to you. What about the Exclusive Brethren? This is the other branch.
That is a massive different kettle of fish. We went up there on Sunday.
Where are they?
They're up in Almesbury. And we went up there Sunday early because we didn't know. They don't advertise their meeting times, just one meeting on a Sunday they advertise.
Okay, so is it an ordinary church or like a parish church style building?
No, no. The gates were locked when we arrived up there. So we looked in and we could see that there was a type of church. It was sort of like a barn and it was in on the ground and there was parking space for about 700 cars.
Wow. So are you talking about an old-fashioned farm-type barn?
No, no, very modern. A place like you wouldn't see it anywhere else. It was just like a big warehouse type of thing.
Oh, crikey. What, like one of these big tin shed type things we see on industrial estates?
Yeah, but quite a good type of one. And we eventually, after waiting for about an hour, this man came in a car and he drove up and introduced himself as Brian and said that he had a service starting and that we could drive in and go right to the top, kind of out of the way, because there'd be 700 people coming in about an hour. So we went up and we waited and the 700 people turned up.
Wow, what time roughly?
About an hour, I think it was about 11, quarter to 11. Anyway, they got out of cars and all the cars were the same, black and grey. And every car was parked homeward bound. No one parked any old place. It was all like...
Oh, they were all in the pointed in the same direction?
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Crikey.
And the gates were locked. So all
isn't it? I mean, because, you know, you don't want car thieves or whatever coming in during the service.
No, but it seemed a bit odd that they were all sort of homeward bound. All the men that got out of the car were dressed in white shirts and black trousers, black shoes. And then the women got out and they were dressed in scarves, small scarves, long hair. Lots of pretty women, young women, older women.
So the scarves, that was to cover the hair, was it?
Yeah, just small scarves and long hair.
Oh.
So we were told, don't come in, because the first start of this service is like private, it's for the congregation, the people. And they said, we'll come and get you when the service starts. So about 20 minutes later, they came out, got Simon and I to go in, and by the side door. And women have to wear dresses. They don't want women wearing trousers. And we were quite shocked when we walked in the entrance to see all these seats in very strange shapes.
Well, hang
black
on, because
leather.
were you wearing a dress or
no, I had
trousers
on.
So you had to get changed, or did they tolerate you?
No, I took my scarf off and made a dress out of it. It worked. I got in. Anyway, there was a massive big bunch of men in the middle in white shirts. All you could see was this massive white array, hundreds, all sitting together.
And now were they all pointing into the middle? Or
no,
what?
Yes, they were all pointing to the middle.
So they all had their backs to the rest of the congregation?
Yes, yes.
And that was the rest of the congregation, women, kids, or what?
Well, then there was women all behind, bunches behind. They weren't in together. And it was great and colourful, and the women all wore, it was like a fashion parade, white high-heeled shoes and pretty clothes.
Well, yeah, but I mean, quite a lot of people do get dressed up to go to church. Yeah, and
but
all
this,
sorts of
this
places.
Was really dressed, and it was like a fashion parade in London. You know, they were all really pretty and dressed and very away from everybody. You wouldn't imagine seeing them walking around Tesco's or anywhere like that. It all went really well, and three men spoke.
So just going back slightly, how long did they make you wait for then outside?
An hour.
Right, so they had something going on inside for an hour after they arrived,
yes,
and then it let you in.
Well, I suppose it was less than an hour by the time we went in, but they didn't want us in until they were ready.
So they had how long in there before you actually...
I suppose a good three quarters of an hour.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah. And then when we went in, a man sat each side of us. We were in the back. We weren't in the congregation. We were at the back in one seat, a leather black seat, and a man sat each side. So
they were almost like guarding you?
Yeah, yes. It felt quite nice in one way, but in another way it felt as if we were kind of under scrutiny. The songs were lovely. The people were like from another world. They looked so clean and so wholesome, and the preaching was really all around Jesus and the Last Supper. And three different men spoke, and the old man that spoke first was kind of crying. So there was a lot of emotion attached to his preaching. And we were quite blessed, but at the same time, they were very exclusive, very...
Well, that's why they're called the Exclusive Brethren.
Yes.
Did they tell you much about their beliefs?
Yes, they told us quite a bit. They don't have any crosses, because we asked them, was there no cross? And they said no.
Did they say why?
Well, they don't sort of... present the cross. They just present a Bible, and they gave us a black Bible each, and they let us take whatever leaflets we wanted to give out to the people we meet on the street. And they were very friendly, very nice, but it was all like we had to move in their procession, their way. And it was all very sort of, you could say, locked in. You didn't feel as if you could get up in the middle of the service and walk out like you do in the Church of England, places like that. You felt you're there, you got to stay till it's over.
Did you get any idea of what they were up to when you were being kept outside?
I think it would have been their business about how much money comes in, what meetings they're having during the week they wouldn't want us to know about, because we turned up out of the blue and they told us to come back to a later meeting that was advertised. But we said, we're here now, we might as well hang on. And so... they let us through. We did get blessed being in there, but we didn't feel as if we were part of it. We were on the outside looking in. And it was a bit of a shock, to be honest, compared to the Church of England, where it seems like it's all a bit of a mixed bunch, as it is
what
in most
churches. What about Holy Communion? Do they have that?
Yes, but I don't think they had it that day, did they? No. No, I don't think they had it when we were there. It was all very quickly over, and things were rushed in the end. Everyone got back in their cars and just drove straight out, and within a few minutes the place was clear. You never know anyone was there.
Amazing.
And the big green gate was locked. So I was just glad
look,
I got out.
The proof of pudding's in the eating, though. Afterwards, how did you feel? I mean, it's almost like if you've been to see a good film or a bad film, when you come out of the cinema, you do get a sense of, was that really worth it or not?
I felt that it was all very, that if I'd been a homeless person or I'd been in need, I don't think we would have got in. Because they have a notice up saying that only certain people, you know, that are well-dressed sort of and are well-dispositioned should come in. And so I think they are very, very together, and that they don't hold the meetings publicly. And it's because they don't want just anybody turning up. And they were a little bit put out by us turning up the way we did. But however, they let us in and they sort of brought us through it and got us to the other side.
Well, it sounds to me like you put a little bit of pressure on them to say, well, actually, we'd rather not go, thanks. We feel led to stay here. And if you hadn't done that, you probably would have...
We wouldn't have got in.
No.
No, I think they would have... on a couple of occasions, they gave us a get-out clause and said we should come back later. But
yeah.
Simon
putting
and I put
off,
quite
yeah.
a lot of effort into getting there, and so we really did want to see what was going to happen without it being prearranged.
What about the leaflets they gave you? What did they teach you or tell you about Exclusive Brethren?
Very good material. which is showing people salvation, how to get saved and how to give up sin. It is a church that doesn't allow any sin in, because one of the preachers talked about fashion and talked against sort of designer clothes and everything.
But hang on, that sounds exactly like what they were up to.
Yes, I was a bit shocked. I said to one of the men, you know, what an amazing amount of shoes these ladies have. Like Marilyn Monroe type 4-inch heels and nice skirts with splits down beside, you know. And I thought it was quite a contradictory to how they seem to be and how very sort of sober the men are. But I think women sort of put a lot into their clothes and their appearance, and therefore it is a bit like a fashion show once you get in.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like a bit of a contrast between what the literature is saying about them and then what you actually experience.
Yes,
is that true?
Yes, and I did feel a bit underdressed, I have to say. Even though I had made a good effort to dress up, I did still feel I didn't fit into the black shirt, the black suit type of thing, and all the lovely colours and all the feeling of a fashion show. So, you know, I came out feeling like I need to go out and shop if I'm coming back here.
Well, I don't know if they probably... Simon, what was your feeling about the church? Is there anything you've got to add to Bridget's account there?
When we walked in, it was in a square, which is actually, as I said last time, very biblical in that it enables every brother to give a word. And when we talked to them, their real bugbear was that they were totally against the clergy system. They were into equality and all this. But as you asked, when we walked in, we thought it was phenomenal. Picture this: it was about 1,000 seats, all in a circle or square. In the first 6 or 7 or 8 rows was the men, all wearing white shirts and black trousers. And then behind them were all the ladies, dressed as Bridget described them, with a few of their children around. And there was an amazing peace, and the singing was completely unified without instruments. And we felt that it was like from a really old age, didn't we? Like a bygone age. It was very long time ago feeling, and we liked it a lot. And as she said, they're very doctrinally pure. They take their Christianity really seriously, which is really good.
Well, it's all very well to say that, but I mean, the idea that, say, if you're homeless, you're not welcome.
Yes, there is a point to that. As Bridget mentioned, all their cars were of a hue of grey, and they were all expensive cars, and they all were identical type of car. They were all those 5-door family...
people mover type.
That sort of thing,
Or are we talking about 4x4s?
No, they weren't 4x4s, but they were all of that same type. One blue, one red we spotted, but the other hundreds were all of a type of, and that was obviously deliberate because they don't believe... For example, Tony, they don't wear ties. They believe that is of the devil.
But women wear scarves, and that's not of the devil.
Well, it says women cover your heads when you pray or prophesy, so that's where they get that from. Now, I don't agree with the ban on ties, but they really do major on the minors. This great conformity.
Would you go back?
We've been invited back.
Would you like to go back there?
We'd like to go for another visit for the purposes of Bristol Community FM, but we wouldn't join the church.
Why not?
Well, we've set up our own, the Bristol Underground Church.
Well, you. I'm asking you personally, why would you not want to join that church?
Well, for that reason, we have our own spirit-filled, spirit-led church. The guys has invited us back, and he said we're allowed to stay in go to one of their small rooms this time, where it's a similar format. And we did have a lot of very good conversations with about 5 or 6 of them before and after the meetings.
What were those conversations about then?
Well, it was doctrinal, as Bridget said.
Well, give us an idea of what they actually believed then. I mean,
yeah,
we've had a pretty good view from Bridget of what the service generally was like, but what do these people believe?
Yeah,
exclusive brethren.
They checked us out. Well, I read their leaflet, their pamphlet that they gave us afterwards in detail, and it is good. It's scriptural. They said two things which struck with me. One, they said at the very beginning, we believe that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord Jesus for salvation will be saved.
And does that include homeless people?
Yes, which is the scripture we use. It's Romans 10:13. And then secondly, they said, "We have always believed that not only the brethren will be in heaven, so this exclusive business is not necessarily an accurate portrayal." And I said to the guy at the end, I challenged him on the two points that I brought up in your last week's interview, about the party walls, you know, that they won't share a semi-detached house. And he said that's for practical reasons, because they've had complaints about the worship in their houses, and also vice versa, they don't like the worldly noise from next door. Then I checked up about this thing about that they dig their own drains, because their separation from the world won't allow them to have the same drains. But he said that's not true. And he said that quite often these bad reports that are spread about them are spread by people who've left the church afterwards. And we found them very friendly, Tony. You know, they were very friendly. But to answer your point about the homeless, there were no poor people there. They all looked identical. And we thought that their jobs, well, I looked through the pamphlet, they're quite high-powered. Most of them are self-employed.
Maybe if a homeless person joins the Exclusive Brethren, then they're not homeless for long.
No.
And they get a high-powered job pretty quick.
Yeah, they do look after their people. They say, for example, when a young married couple marry, they will help them to buy a house, they will help do it up. They look after their people, certainly.
Okay, anything final to add, Bridget?
Yes, they don't watch television or radio.
Oh, well, they won't be listening to this then?
Not as far as they told us.
And why do they say they do that then?
They keep the media out, probably newspapers and everything, and they try to keep everything out of their lives except God and going to church and all the things to do. But the lovely clothes and everything they wear reminds me of the Catholic Church back in Ireland when I went there years ago. They're all really well dressed, and had cars and came in the same type of way. But they couldn't identify with the poor, the needy. And so I think this probably got, you know, it's a people's church, but they have to be all of a similar type of person. And I don't think everybody would fit in there. I certainly wouldn't. I'd be a bit like a fish out of water, because I couldn't park my car in the same way twice or dress up or keep that type of conduct, code of conduct they have. And okay. It looks lovely, and it's lovely to look in, and everybody should have a look in there, because it's really a blessing to see them and how pure and everything they are. And perhaps there's a lot we can learn from them.
Well, I mean, wonders what goes on behind the scenes, though.
That's what I did say. I'd like to be around a while and be a fly on the wall and see what really goes on, if this is as good as it is. If it is, it's fantastic to see people like them living in the world.
And quite
today.
Often, I mean, for example, with the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, you may go to a service, it might be very exciting, wonderful, and then you realise actually it's a cult, because the
yes.
people at the very top are completely exclusive about what they do, and they control it from the top. And it's actually very secretive at the top.
Yes.
They see themselves as, you know, better than others.
That's true. And I think from that point of view, I'd prefer to be out on the street and doing the church life the way we do, and meeting the homeless and all the needy people we do. I wouldn't want to be in a pew every week being dressed up like that, because I just couldn't do it. It's like modelling every week. It must be.
Okay. All right, Simon and Bridget from Bristol Underground Church, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect, and we'll have another review in a few weeks' time.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy that's not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy, with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Ripplinger is a US writer who uncovered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, that is the translation which he owned, is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek, deleting references to fasting and prayer, for example. And even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered deliberately. So here's Gail Ripplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions.
You may wonder, why is the New International Version having so many problems? Part of it has to do with the translators, and I could probably go through any number of translators here and select some of the books that they've written and explain to you why they would agree with some of the changes in the New Bible versions. But I've selected one, Virginia Molencott, because I think she's a very interesting person there. Now this incidentally, is a list that was produced by the International Bible Society. And so I marked her name on here, Virginia Molin Conner. Here's a picture of her. And she said in the Episcopal Witness in June of 1991, quote, "My lesbianism has always been a part of me." So Virginia Mollenkott is a lesbian. Now, she wrote a book called Sensuous Spirituality Out from Fundamentalism. Now, the definition of fundamentalism is a belief in the literal meaning of the Bible. In other words, if the Bible says up, it means up. If it says down, it means down. A fundamentalist would not allegorize the Bible. They would take it literally. Okay, so she is moving out from fundamentalism. All right. Now, in her book, Is the Homosexual My Neighbor?, which is another one of her books, she said that the Bible does not censor homosexuality. It only censors criminal offenders. Okay, so in her NIV, it says homosexual offenders. In other words, someone who had been found guilty of a criminal act. All right. Now, the Authorized King James Version simply says effeminate. It comes from the root of the word meaning soft, okay, like pliable. That's where the word comes from. It has absolutely nothing to do with the word criminal offenders. Okay, but you can see her belief, as expressed in her book, Is the Homosexual My Neighbor, is right there in the NIV Bible. Now, she has completely omitted, whether it's been her or another party that I'll mention later, the term sodomite in the Old Testament. So you will not find the word sodomite in the Old Testament in the NIV, in Deuteronomy Kings, because she doesn't believe that the Bible censors that sort of thing. Now, this is what she said in this book, Sensuous Spirituality, and I'll quote you. "Because we are living in the enemy-occupied territory, I'm calling it a heteropatriarchy. Now, heteropatriarchy just means straight men. Okay, I'll translate that for you. We must learn to subvert. Subversion means a systematic attempt to overthrow or undermine." And then she goes on another page, "by working secretly within the system." Okay. Now, in this book, Sensuous Spirituality, she talks about her use of the I Ching and tarot cards. Both of these are divination, and they're a form of occultism. All right. She talks about her ongoing relationship with her mother. And most importantly, she talks about her ability to do automatic writing. Now, automatic writing is something that occultists do. And she says, quote, "the words pour onto the pen very rapidly." And so I would suspect when the words were pouring onto the pen, when she was working on the NIV, they were pouring in from some sort of evil spirit kind of a person. But there was another person on the NIV committee. As a matter of fact, this person was one of the most important members. His name is Dr. Woodstra. Dr. Woodstra was the chairman of the Old Testament Committee. He was the gentleman who in the 1950s inspired the idea at Calvin College of the NIV, and he pushed it all the way through in the 60s. Now, in the January 1992 publication called The Record, which is a pro-homosexual newspaper, The Record said, quote, "Woodstra was a longtime friend of the EC. The EC is a group called the Evangelicals Concerned. These are homosexuals who believe that it's all right to be a homosexual and to be a Christian." Okay? They said that Woodstra was their longtime friend and that he took the view that the Bible contained nothing censoring homosexuality. Well, as you can see, his Old Testament does contain nothing censoring homosexuality because it says shrine prostitutes. Now, at Kent State University, I knew a number of sodomites. Okay, I knew no shrine prostitutes. All right. Mrs. Mollenkott said something else. She went to the Presbyterian Church's USA's Goddess Worship Reimaging Conference. And you can see the woman, the picture there of the woman raising her hands in worship. And just in a few minutes, I'll show you what she was worshiping. Okay? But at that conference, Virginia Mollenkott says, the monism, M-O-N-I-S-M, that's the belief that the universe is God, which would mean you and I were a part of God. Okay? Now, Christianity teaches that God and the universe are separate, that God created the universe. Okay? This is Hinduism that she's talking about. The monism that I'm talking about assumes that God is so all-inclusive that she is involved in every cell of those who are thoughts in her mind and embodiments of her image. Okay? Now, what were they worshiping? What was that woman worshiping? They were worshiping this. And the caption underneath this in the magazine article was, "The Heart of the Beast." They were worshiping something called the Heart of the Beast. Now, remember it says they worship the beast in the book of Revelation? Now, who would want to worship the beast? You know, you can't imagine these things happening. But there's the picture of these women raising their hands and worshiping this beast. Okay? Now, when you confront the International Bible Society or the NIV people about the involvement of some of their translators, they will deny, you know, everything that you can think of. And so someone corresponded with Miss Mollenkott, and she was kind enough to write back to them. And she said, quote, "You are right. Baker is playing little word games." That's the chairman of the International Bible Society and the NIV chairman right now, Mr. Barker. She said he's playing word games. Then another note, she said, "If you want to do me an even greater favor, you can set the record straight with the IBS." That's the owner of the copyright of the NIV. "But perhaps they would rather not be disturbed by the facts." Okay. So if you call the NIV, IBS out in Colorado Springs, they'll deny all of this. And we have a letter from Ms. Mollenkott, and she was kind enough to respond. Now, the monism that she's talking about is the idea that God is one. And there are some other lesbian authors out there who wrote a book called Changing of the Gods. And Naomi Goldberg said, "God is going to change. We are going to bring an end of him." Okay? So you can see the King James does refer to God as he or him, perennially. Okay? In the NASB, in the NIV, he becomes the one. He is inclusive. In other words, he is the he, she. Ted Koppel did an analysis with his audience, and he said, how many people believe God is a he? How many people believe he's a he, she? And how many people don't know what they believe? 47% of his audience said that he was a he, she. 47% of the audience would agree with this he, she notion, the one. Okay? Now, who is this one that they're worshiping? Now, one of the poems or one of the phrases that the Theosophical Society has talks about someone called the Coming One. And at the end of that poem, it says, "Let death fulfill the purpose of the Coming One." Okay, now they're not talking about the death of the Lord Jesus Christ. They're talking about the death of Christians, I'm afraid. Okay, the purpose of the Coming One. Now, the Bible tells us who the Coming One is in 2 Thessalonians, whose coming is after the working of Satan. That's the Antichrist. Okay. Unfortunately, the New King James, instead of having he, which God identifies himself with the male gender, they have the Coming One in Luke 7:20. Now, another name in Lucius Trust literature is the Mighty One, all right? Another name for Lucifer. They said, "Come forth, O Mighty One, and let death fulfill the purpose of the Coming One." So his name is the Mighty One or the Coming One. So in the NIV and the NASB, you have he, God, or the Lord God, changed to the Mighty One, the Mighty One, the Mighty One. Now let's look and see who the Mighty One is. Okay. Now, this glossary of which words and terms says the definition for the devil is little god, title for the magister, as representative of one of the mighty ones. Diana and Lucifer, of the above-mentioned witch legend, are but figurative terms for the mighty ones. All right, I could probably give you 50 other cult books that identify the devil as the mighty one.
Gail Ripplinger there, talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions, speaking about Rupert Murdoch's New International Translation of the Bible, shockingly less accurate than the King James Version from the 17th century. More from her in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Simon and Bridget from Bristol Underground Church, Gail Ripplinger and Lady Diana. Also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
I've got no bags and packs to slow me down. I'm a travelling so fast my feet ain't touching the ground. I'm travelling light, I'm travelling light. Cos I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight. No comb and no toothbrush, I've got nothing to hold. I am carrying only a heart full of love and a pocket full of dreams, and they weigh nothing at all. Soon we're gonna see that love light in her eyes. I'm a whoopin' and a hollerin' away from paradise. I'm travelling light, I'm travelling light. Cos I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight. Cos I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight. No comb and no toothbrush, I've got nothing to hold. I am carrying only a heart full of love and a pocket full of dreams, and they weigh nothing at all. Soon we're gonna see that love light in her eyes. Well, I'm a whoop and a holler and away from paradise. I'm travelling light, I'm travelling light. Cos I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight. Well, I've got no bags and packs to slow me down. I'm a travelling so fast my feet ain't touching the ground. I'm travelling light, I'm travelling light. Cos I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight. I just can't wait to be with my baby tonight.